I was not surprised, but I was pretty appalled to read a perspective in the Washington Post written by a former corporate propagandist explaining that his job had been to smear the Canadian healthcare system to purposefully misinform Americans. Are there cocktail parties where people introduce themselves? Hi, I'm an arms dealer. What kind of work do you do, corporate propagandist? Wow, fascinating. Tell me more. Have you met Charlie? He buys and sells prisons. Well, enough. You get what I'm saying. How do they sleep at night? At first, I thought maybe the author Wendell Potter would talk about his guilt and express his remorse. But in the end, I think it is better that he simply owned up to harming people through his job. The article lays out his actions and the consequences. His feelings are his to live with and not ours to pass judgment on. So let's get going on this article, which is titled The Healthcare Scare: I Sold Americans a Lie About Canadian Medicine. Now we're paying the price. This was published on August 6th, 2020. In my prior life as an insurance executive, it was my job to deceive Americans about their health care. I misled people to protect profits. In fact, one of my major objectives as a corporate propagandist was to do my part to enhance shareholder value. That work contributed directly to a climate in which fewer people are insured, which has shaped our nation's struggle against the coronavirus, a condition that we can fight only if everyone is willing and able to get medical treatment. Had spokesmen like me not been paid to obscure important truths about the differences between the U.S. and Canadian healthcare systems, tens of thousands of Americans who have died during the pandemic might still be alive. In 2007, I was working as Vice President of Corporate Communications for Cigna. That summer, Michael Moore was preparing to release his latest documentary, Sicko, contrasting American healthcare with that in other rich countries. Naturally, we looked terrible. I spent months meeting secretly with my counterparts at other big insurers to plot our assault on the film, which contained many anecdotes about patients who had been denied coverage for important treatments. One example was 3-year-old Annette No. When her parents asked Cigna to pay for 2 cochlear implants that would allow her to hear, we agreed to cover only one. Clearly, my colleagues and I would need a robust defense. On a task force for the industry's biggest trade association, America's Health Insurance Plans, or AHIP, we talked about how we might make healthcare systems in Canada, France, Britain, and even Cuba look just as bad as ours. We enlisted APCO Worldwide, a giant PR firm. Agents there worked with AHIP to put together a binder of laminated talking points for company flacks like me to use in news releases and statements to reporters. Here's an example from one AHIP brief in the binder. A May 2004 poll found that 87% of Canada's business leaders would support seeking health care outside the government system if they had a pressing medical concern. The source was a 2004 book by Sally Pipes, president of the industry-supported Pacific Research Institute, titled Miracle Cure: How to Solve America's Healthcare Crisis and Why Canada Isn't the Answer. Another bullet point from the same book quoted the CEO of the Canadian Association of Radiologists as saying that the radiology equipment in Canada is so bad that without immediate action, radiologists will no longer be able to guarantee the reliability and quality of examinations. Much of this runs against the experience of many Americans, especially the millions who take advantage of low pharmaceutical prices in Canada to meet their prescription needs. But there were more specific reasons to be skeptical of those claims. We didn't know, for example, who conducted that 2004 survey, or anything about the sample size or methodology, or even what criteria were used to determine who qualified as a business leader. We didn't know if the assertion about imaging equipment was based on reliable data or was an opinion. you could easily turn up comparable complaints about outdated equipment at U.S. hospitals. Contacted by the Washington Post, an AHIP spokesman said, "This perspective was from the pre-ACA past. We are future-focused by building on what works and fixing what doesn't." He added that the organization believes everyone deserves affordable, high-quality coverage and care, regardless of health status, income, or pre-existing conditions. An APCO Worldwide spokesperson told the Post that the company has been involved in supporting our clients with the evolution of the healthcare system. We are proud of our work. Cigna did not respond to requests for comment. Nevertheless, I spent much of that year as an industry spokesman, my last after 20 years in the business, spreading AHIP's, quote, information, end quote, to journalists and lawmakers to create the impression that our healthcare system was far superior to Canada's, which we wanted people to believe was on the verge of collapse. The campaign worked. Stories began to appear in the press that cast the Canadian system in a negative light. And when Democrats began writing what would become the Affordable Care Act in early 2009, they gave no serious consideration to a publicly financed system like Canada's. We succeeded so wildly at defining that idea as radical that Senator Max Baucus, Democrat in Montana, then chair of the Senate Finance Committee, had single-payer supporters ejected from a hearing. Today, the respective responses of Canada and the United States to the coronavirus pandemic prove just how false the ideas I helped spread were. There are more than three times as many coronavirus infections per capita in the United States, and the mortality rate is twice the rate in Canada. And although we now test more people per capita, our northern neighbor had much earlier successes with testing, which helped make a difference throughout the pandemic. The most effective myth we perpetuated, the industry trots it out whenever major reform is proposed, is that Canadians and people in other single-payer countries have to endure long waits for needed care. Just last year, in a statement submitted to a congressional committee for a hearing on the Medicare for All Act of 2019, AHIP maintained that patients would pay more to wait longer for worse care under a single-payer system. While it's true that Canadians sometimes have to wait weeks or months for elective procedures, knee replacements are often cited, the truth is that they do not have to wait at all for the vast majority of medical services. And, contrary to another myth I used to peddle, that Canadian doctors are flocking to the United States, there are more doctors per 1,000 people in Canada than here. Canadians see their doctors an average of 6.8 times a year, compared with just 4 times a year in this country. Most important, no one in Canada is turned away from doctors because of a lack of funds, and Canadians can get tested and treated for the coronavirus without fear of receiving a budget-busting medical bill. That undoubtedly is one of the reasons Canada's COVID-19 death rate is so much lower than ours. In America, exorbitant bills are a defining feature of our healthcare system. Despite the assurances from President Trump and members of Congress that COVID-19 patients will not be charged for testing or treatment, they are on the hook for big bills, according to numerous reports. That is not the case in Canada, where there are no co-pays, deductibles, or co-insurance for covered benefits. Care is free at the point of service. And those laid off in Canada don't face the worry of losing their health insurance. In the United States, by contrast, more than 40 million have lost their jobs during this pandemic, and millions of them, along with their families, also lost their coverage. Then there's quality of care. By numerous measures, it is better in Canada. Some examples, Canada has far lower rates than the United States of hospitalizations from preventable causes like diabetes, almost twice as common here, and hypertension, more than 8 times as common. And even though Canada spends less than half what we do per capita on healthcare, Life expectancy there is 82 years compared with 78.6 years in the United States. When the pandemic reached North America, Canadian hospitals, which operate under annual global budgets, fixed payments typically allocated at the provincial and regional levels to cover operating expenses, were better prepared for the influx of patients than many U.S. hospitals, and Canada ramped up production of personal protective equipment much more quickly than we did. Of the many regrets I have about what I once did for a living, one of the biggest is slandering Canada's healthcare system. If the United States had undertaken a different kind of reform in 2009 or any time since, one that didn't rely on private insurance companies that have every incentive to limit what they pay for, we'd be a healthier country today. Living without insurance dramatically increases your chances of dying unnecessarily. Over the past 13 years, tens of thousands of Americans have probably died prematurely because, unlike our neighbors to the north, they either had no coverage or were so inadequately insured that they couldn't afford the care they needed. I live with that horror and my role in it every day. And I think that is quite an article and quite a confession. We move now to a different type of misinformation. This is written by Tanya Lewis for Scientific American and was published on August 18th, 2020. This is titled, 9 COVID-19 Myths That Just Won't Go Away. As the world continues to battle the coronavirus, it is also fighting a different sort of epidemic, misinformation. This infodemic is just as harmful as COVID-19 itself, leading people to downplay the severity of the disease and ignore public health advice in favor of unproved treatments or cures. A recent survey by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation and Gallup found that 4 in 5 Americans say the online spread of misinformation is the biggest problem facing the media. Even with widely available evidence to the contrary, beliefs are hard to change. Here are some of the most insidious falsehoods about the pandemic and why they are wrong. Myth number 1. The novel coronavirus was engineered in a lab in China. Because the pathogen first emerged and began infecting people in Wuhan, China, President Donald Trump has claimed, without evidence, that it started in a laboratory there. Some conspiracy theorists have even speculated it was engineered as a bioweapon, although U.S. intelligence agencies have categorically denied this possibility, stating that the intelligence community concurs with the wide scientific consensus that the COVID-19 virus was not man-made or genetically modified. No credible evidence has emerged to support an accidental lab release either. As Scientific American reported earlier this year, and I apologize, I will not get this name correctly, Chinese virologist Shi Zhengli, who studies bat coronaviruses, and whose laboratory Trump and others had suggested was COVID-19's source, compared the pathogen's sequence against that of other coronaviruses her team had sampled from bat caves and found that it did not match any of them. Zhengli also explained in detail why her lab could not have been the source of the virus in a lengthy response in Science. In reaction to calls for an independent international investigation into how the virus originated, China has invited researchers from the World Health Organization to discuss the scope of such a mission. But the evidence suggests SARS-CoV-2 was not created in a lab. Myth 2. Wealthy elites intentionally spread the virus to win power and profit. In a video from a conspiracy theory film entitled Plandemic and a book she co-authored, a woman named Judy Mikovits, who once published a high-profile, now retracted study on chronic fatigue syndrome, makes unsubstantiated claims about National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases director Anthony Fauci and Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates, suggesting they have used their power to profit from disease. Science and the website PolitiFact have fact-checked some of the film's claims, many of which appear elsewhere in this article. The video was widely shared by anti-vaxxers and the conspiracy theory group QAnon. It garnered more than 8 million views on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram before it was taken down because of its false statements. Yet, the large number of people who watched it suggests misinformation spreads perniciously. Myth 3. COVID-19 is no worse than the flu. Starting in the early days of the pandemic, Trump has repeatedly claimed that the disease is not more dangerous than seasonal influenza. Although COVID-19's exact mortality rate is hard to pin down, epidemiologists suspect it is far higher than that of the flu. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that the latter causes roughly 12,000 to 61,000 deaths per year in the U.S. By contrast, COVID-19 has caused more than 169,000 deaths in the country as of this writing. Many people also have partial immunity to the flu because of vaccination or prior infection, whereas most of the world has not yet encountered COVID-19. So no, coronavirus is not just the flu. Myth number 4, you don't need to wear a mask. Although early guidance on masks from the CDC and the WHO was confusing and inconsistent, there is now a strong consensus among public health authorities, supported by numerous studies, that wearing a face covering can limit the transmission of the coronavirus through small exhaled droplets. Masks have long been known as an effective means of source control, preventing a sick patient from spreading a disease to others. But the early guidance was based in part on the fact that there was a shortage of high-quality N95 and surgical masks. We now know that cloth face masks can be an effective alternative. But despite the evidence, many people still refuse to wear one, considering it a violation of civil liberties or emasculating. Georgia's Governor Brian Kemp went so far as to sign an executive order banning city governments from implementing mask mandates. And he sued Atlanta's mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, when she instituted one, although he has now dropped the lawsuit. But as coronavirus cases have spiked around the U.S. in recent months, even states that were once staunch holdouts have now implemented mask orders. Myth number 5. Hydroxychloroquine is an effective treatment. When a small, now widely criticized study in France suggested the malaria drug hydroxychloroquine might be effective at treating the disease, Trump and others seized on it and have continued to tout the medication despite growing evidence that it does not benefit COVID-19 patients. In a tweet, Trump called the hydroxychloroquine treatment one of the biggest game changers in the history of medicine, and he has mentioned it repeatedly in his public coronavirus briefings. The Food and Drug Administration initially issued an emergency use authorization for the drug, but the agency later warned against its use because of the risk of heart problems and ultimately revoked its authorization. Several studies have shown that hydroxychloroquine does not protect against COVID-19 in those who were exposed. And in June, the National Institutes of Health halted its clinical trial of the medication, stating that while it was not harmful to patients, it did not provide any benefit. Yet, Trump continues to hype the drug. Just a few weeks ago, he retweeted a video, viewed tens of millions of times, before social media companies took it down, featuring Stella Emanuel, a Houston, Texas-based physician, who has made questionable assertions in the past, including that doctors had used alien DNA in treatments and that demons cause certain medical conditions by having sex with people in their dreams, claiming hydroxychloroquine is an effective treatment for COVID-19. Myth number 6. The Black Lives Matter protests led to increased transmission. When thousands of people started taking to the streets in late May and June to protest the police killing of George Floyd and violence against Black Americans, some people questioned whether the mass gatherings would cause a spike in coronavirus cases. But despite the concerns of Republicans such as Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio that the demonstrations pose as big a risk as going to church or the gym, such a marked increase from the protests has not been observed. A white paper analysis of protests in 315 of the largest U.S. cities by the National Bureau of Economic Research found no evidence that they led to more COVID-19 cases or deaths. And those who did not attend the protests may actually have stayed home more than they would have otherwise. The fact that the demonstrations happened outdoors, where the risk of transmission is much lower, and that many protesters wore masks likely prevented super-spreading events. Meanwhile, as states have reopened, there has been a notable increase in cases tied to bars and restaurants, as well as other indoor environments, likely because of the risk of airborne spread. Myth number 7, spikes in cases are because of increased testing. As coronavirus cases began surging in many parts of the U.S. in recent months, Trump has frequently claimed that these spikes are merely to the result of more people being tested. He has tweeted that, "Without testing, we would be showing almost no cases," and has said in interviews that the reason they appear to have gone up is because of increased testing. If that scenario were true, we would expect the percentage of positive tests to go down. But numerous analyses have shown the opposite. The rate has risen in many states with big outbreaks, such as Arizona, Texas, and Florida, while it has decreased in those that have controlled their outbreaks, such as New York, indicating that the national increase in positive tests reflects a true increase in cases. Myth 8, we can achieve herd immunity by letting the virus spread through the population. Early on in the pandemic, some speculated that the policies chosen by the UK and Sweden gave the impression that they planned on letting the virus circulate through their population until they reached herd immunity, the point at which enough people are immune to the virus to prevent it from spreading to others. Both nations' governments have denied that this idea was their official strategy, but the UK was late to issue a full lockdown, and Sweden had decided against widespread restrictions. There is a fundamental flaw with this approach, however. Experts estimate that roughly 60 to 70% of people would need to get COVID-19 to achieve herd immunity. And given the relatively high mortality rate of the disease, letting it infect that many individuals could lead to millions of deaths. That tragedy is what happened during the 1918 influenza pandemic, in which roughly 50 million people are thought to have perished. The UK's COVID-19 death rate is among the world's highest. Sweden, for its part, has had significantly more deaths than neighboring countries, and its economy has suffered despite not shutting down. It is likely that many lives could have been saved if these countries had acted sooner. Myth number 9. Any vaccine will be unsafe and a bigger risk than getting COVID-19. As scientists race to develop a vaccine against the disease, worrying reports have emerged that many people may refuse to get one once it is available. Conspiracy theories about potential vaccines have circulated among anti-vax groups and in viral videos. In Plandemic, Mikovits falsely claims that any COVID-19 vaccine will kill millions, and that other vaccines have done so. In fact, vaccines save millions of lives each year. Another conspiracy theory asserts that Bill Gates has a secret plan to use vaccines to implant trackable microchips in people. Gates has denied the claim, which is not supported by evidence. Most Americans still support vaccination, yet the few voices of opposition have been growing. A recent study observed that although clusters of anti-vaxxers on Facebook are smaller than pro-vaccination groups, they are more heavily interconnected with clusters of undecided people. A recent Gallup poll found that 1 in 3 Americans would not get a COVID-19 vaccine if it were available today, with Republicans being less likely to be vaccinated than Democrats. There is good reason to be cautious about the safety of a new vaccine, but the need for prudence is why the top contenders are currently conducting large-scale clinical trials in tens of thousands of people to determine safety and efficacy. If one or more of them pass muster, it will be critical for people to get vaccinated to save lives, including perhaps their own. And there we have our second article from Scientific American with 9 myths regarding COVID-19. And I have a list of, last week we did a list of men's preventive care, which should still be looked after, even though we are in a pandemic. They have on the list for women an annual OBGYN visit, and you should do that once a year if you are under the age of 65. Blood pressure screening. If you are age 40 or above and at high risk, you should go once a year. Age 18 to 40 and not high risk, every 3 to 5 years. Cervical cancer screening, ages 21 to 65, every 3 years. Cholesterol screening, everyone, every 4 to 6 years, more often if you have family history or other risk factors. Colorectal cancer screening, age 50 to 75, regular testing, earlier if at higher risk. Diabetes type 2 screening, age 40 to 70 and overweight or obese, you should do that once a year. HIV screening, ages 15 to 65, at least once in a lifetime, once a year if at high risk. And there you have it. Thank you for tuning in to Sound Body today. Stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas.